Great. In the interest of time, we're going to go ahead and get started. Since you're such a huge crowd, feel free to come closer. We can give you personalized attention. Let's see. So how we're going to work this is that there'll be one presentation. We're going to do the using disaster events as a use case for health information exchange to go first. And then my colleagues from Prince George's County will go next to talk about ADT alerting. And then we'll take kind of questions after each of the presentations. So, or in this case, if you all want to stop us during, that's totally fine too. All right. So this is our non-disclosure, our disclosure statement. So just so everyone's happy. So we're going to start off and talk about HIE, the overall landscape. My colleague Lee Stevens here from the Office of the National Coordinator will also be talking about that. Then we'll have Kevin Horan, who will talk about emergency medical services and give you some tidbits. And then I'll wrap it up in regards to connecting both of the two. So, all right, with that, Lee.
Thank you, Rachel. I'm Lee Stevens. I'm the Director of State Policy at the Office for the National Coordinator for Health IT. I was talking to my dad last night, and I said, we're speaking tomorrow. Me and a group of people are speaking at McCormick Place. And he said, you must be talking to like 20 or 25,000 people. I have to call him back later and be like, no, actually seven. But thank you for being here, because we've been working on health information exchange at the Office of the National Coordinator for quite a few years, and you know, there are some real breakthroughs in some places, and there are other places where we're still having challenges. This is a new market, basically, and we're having to really figure out what's sustainable when it comes to HIE. And one way to do that is to figure out what other services we should be providing that both meet the public good and that provide some benefit that make people interested in participating with HIE. One of these particularly is emergency medical services. When we think about building exchange networks, we're really looking at building the capacity of the local models. We want to really reduce the cost that's associated, provide more value, offer shared services, and really figure out what the policies are that are necessary to encourage exchange. A lot of those policies end up being determined by what people actually want to do, and they emerge very quickly. There's lots of interest right now in behavioral health data exchange, figuring out how to look at that, how to think about it. And one of the things that we started focusing on recently, as I mentioned, was EMS. And we were thinking particularly about California. And California has 43 separate health information exchange organizations. That's incredible, because when you're trying to find patient data across those 43 HIEs, not very easy. I mean, that's a pretty staggering challenge. So when we're thinking about ensuring exchange across networks and EMS, we want to make sure that every provider has at least one option for exchange, that we are dealing with the governance and trust that makes everyone confident in the information that they're sharing and making available to others. We want to make sure that we've got common standards to connect the nodes. That's been one of the pieces that's been really tricky in this place, because we're trying to support a market that's innovating as it's standing up. So it's very difficult to say, you got to use these standards, and then find out a year later, oh, well, those standards are outdated now. There's something brand new that's better. We're also looking, of course, at expanding the EMS. EHR adoption. It's pretty clear, if you take a look at this, that we've had some pretty rapid uptake of EHR adoption across the United States. When we look at the number of certified EHRs. We have a certification program at ONC that qualifies providers to receive meaningful use dollars. And in that category, we're looking at about 96.9%. And a basic EHR system is accounting for about 75.5%. The state adoption rates, really where exchange is happening, this is a pretty dramatic shift over 3 years, and we're really excited about this. We have a lot of states now where we're starting to see them dip into the 40 to 60 and the 60 to 80 category. And you can really see the change. You can see, you know, places like Indiana that have one of the best exchanges around. We were talking about that a moment ago. They're way up on the scale at over 80%. Other places, Virginia, the D.C., Maryland region, a lot of exchange going on. And we expect to see this continue to grow. We have our fingers crossed that we're over the hump on HIE and that everyone is going to share electronically. HIE between disparate hospitals, this is a really tricky one because making that information available across competitors that we don't think of them as competitors, but from a business standpoint, these hospitals are like, we got to keep our patients here, we got to provide them the best services, and if we give all their data to the guy down the street, they may choose to go there. So this has been something that has been very difficult to do, but that we're seeing a lot of quick uptake happen. You'll see in 2014, we're really getting into the 60 to 79% and some above 80. HIE models. When we think about the different types of models that support health information exchange, we've really seen four categories emerge across the United States. There's the elevator, which is the rapid facilitation of directed exchange. That's basically email to email. That's not really structured data exchange. That's more, here's one data point or one record, I'm going to email it to you. Capacity builder, that's really bolstering of substate exchanges and really making sure that you have all of your area lit up across your state. It may not be interconnected, but you do have exchange happening across your state. That's something that we really focused on the state HIE program. The orchestrator is a thin layer state level network to connect existing sub-state exchanges. That is really what we're looking at to support the EMS project that you'll hear a bit more about in a few minutes. That's really saying, hey, we've got 43 HIEs here, we're going to connect them with a thin layer across the board. And those are the kinds of things that can really start to provide an incredible amount of value at the state level when you can start to access across disparate HIEs, disparate hospitals. Finally, the public utility model. This has been in and out of vogue over the past few years. The public utility is really a statewide HIE. Everyone is connected to it. Probably the best and biggest example in the country is in New York. It's the State Health Information Network of New York. Their master patient index has, as of a couple of weeks ago, 28.6 million distinct records in it. So that's more than New York State. That's including people from New Jersey and Connecticut and anywhere around the world who might receive health care in New York. HIE and the patient seeking care, we're really looking here. Oops. Sorry about that. We're really looking to support a plan where we can really find patient information to support unplanned care. This is something we all learned from Hurricane Katrina. There are emergencies. We need access to medication histories and to patient records. We also, of course, want to be able to send and receive patient information to support care coordination. That's on a basic day-to-day use. And then, of course, we have the consumer-mediated piece of health information exchange. that has also been slow to take off, but one of these days, everybody is going to say, it would be so easy if I just had all my medical records available through this app on my phone. And it's available, but it's just like getting people to think about it in that way, because most Americans do not think that they are qualified to look at their medical records, and that's crazy. We have to get people to want their records. So I am going to turn it over here to Kevin.
Okay, thanks Lee, and thanks for joining us this afternoon. What I thought I would do is take a few minutes and just kind of maybe answer a question I hope that you're asking yourself right now, and that's why EMS? Why is it important for EMS to be a part of Health Information Exchange? I think the answer is obvious, but that's because I'm a paramedic and I started out in the back of an ambulance or thinking about what happens in sort of the pre-hospital, or even now what we're calling more the out-of-hospital environment. My name is Kevin Horahan. I am with ASPR, which is the HHS Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response. I spent a lot of years working as a paramedic before I sort of started to be a carpet dweller, as we call it. And so this issue is important to me when I think about it from my prior life, but it's also important to me when I think about my future life and my family and my role now at ASPR and thinking about preparedness for not just large-scale events, but just for the day-to-day issues that we face. I'm the guy at ASPR, and even Rachel and Lee probably see this for me a lot. I'm the guy who says, you know, we're always talking about disasters, but, you know, Tuesday afternoon, it's pretty bad Tuesday afternoon, and that's something that we have to get, we have to come to grips with. And so I just, let me give you a little bit, a couple of nuggets about what EMS is, what EMS providers do, how they interface with the system now, with the larger healthcare system now, or where they sit in the healthcare system. And I think that's maybe a better way to describe it, because they really are, they're medical providers who are part of the system. They're not, it used to be that they were kind of over here, there's some, a little bit of kind of multiple personality disorder where EMS folks want to be public safety, they want to be first response type people, but we really are part of the healthcare system. So that's kind of your standard setup, right? That's an ambulance probably with a few too many people that should go inside of it. But it's people who are trained at various levels. So you have first responders. Mostly that's police officers, people who are trained in CPR, first aid, not really an EMS role traditionally. That's pre-emergency medical services, but the majority of EMS providers are EMTs, emergency medical technicians. It's basic life support is what it's called. It's people who are trained, obviously, in CPR. They're trained in the use of defibrillators. They're trained in lots of stabilization techniques. Handful of treatments. It's growing a little bit as time goes on. Some medication administration, EpiPens now with naloxone administration, aspirin, nebulized medications, or at least assisting people with nebulized medications. But predominantly, they are your kind of the workhorses of the EMS world. They are the folks who do the transportation. They pick people up, car crashes, sick in the middle of the night. That's your big the big chunk of EMS, your EMTs, basic life support. Is it critically important for them to have the sort of information that we're talking about? I think the answer is it's important for them. I don't know if I think. If we had to make a draw a line somewhere and say, does all of EMS have to be able to push and pull to the Health Information Exchange? I don't know. It's a question mark. I think in a perfect world. We should aspire to get there so that every medical provider has a full picture of the patient that they're taking care of, and every other medical provider, and as Lee points out, the patient has full visibility on what happened. You know, if I stuck an EpiPen in your leg, that should probably electronically be recorded in your health records. So that's kind of the basic, for pardon the pun there, the basic EMS provider level. Then from there, it gets a little bit more interesting. So there have been, over the years, differing levels of kind of intermediate care. So you have advanced EMTs or intermediate EMTs, or in Maryland, where I'm a paramedic, there have been things like the cardiac rescue technicians, and other states have kind of similar intermediate level. And that's where you start getting more drugs are available to them, more procedures are available to them, things that you absolutely should be part of a patient's medical record. And again, not to diminish anything that a basic life support provider does, but if it's, you know, if I transport you to the hospital and I take your vital signs and I give that report over to hospital staff, you know, we could probably live with that. But if I perform some kind of invasive procedure on you, or I give you some kind of medication, or I, you know, cardiovert you, defibrillate you, do something, intubate you, those are the sorts of things that you really want to be a part. And again, I think that the answer is that all of these should be a part of someone's kind of permanent record. But that's the intermediate. And so then you have the higher level of EMS provider, paramedics. Paramedics have a bigger list of drugs that they can provide, a longer list of procedures, more training, more assessment training, which is really the important part of paramedic training. And those are the kinds of things that are absolutely critically valuable for taking care of a patient when other medical providers don't have visibility on the scene. What does that car crash look like? What does that patient's house look like? Is that house, is the house messy, full of pet hair and cigarette smoke? Well kept, not well kept? What? All of the types of things that paint a picture for the care of a patient and for the ongoing care of a patient. How many times does this patient get seen by the EMS providers? Did they go to the hospital every time? Did they refuse treatment or refuse transportation? All of those things become important pieces of information for the care of that patient for that instance, but also over time. And then beyond paramedic, you then have a growing segment of EMS. And in the past, you've always had critical care paramedics, flight paramedics, flight nurses, people who do other critical care transports, but now you're starting to see innovation in the EMS space with mobile integrated healthcare, community paramedicine, really extensions of not even hospital care, but extensions of primary care, extensions of specialty care, follow-up, post-discharge, post-surgery, in between visits to primary care physicians or other mid-level providers, nurse practitioners, PAs. And now what you really have is you have a gaping hole in the ability of these providers to access the past records, but also to push for future reference records related to their visits, their assessments, any treatments. And again, it's not even, at that point, it's not so much about the treatments, but it's about is that patient compliant with their medications? Did they do a weigh-in? Did they do a 12-lead EKG? Did they do a blood pressure check? Did they do some other patient assessment in that sort of maybe post-discharge from surgery or a checkup for a CHF patient who's maybe had lots of admissions in that past year. So that is that's another case, and again, this is painting that picture of why the access is important. And then the last piece, and this is sort of the piece that I get to somewhat reluctantly, but it's where we kind of hung our hat for this project that Rachel will tell you about, is the disaster piece. The disaster piece for EMS, we're the first ones there. It's not what we really sign up for. We sign up for that day-to-day sick person car crash, whatever the incident happens to be. But when the big one happens, EMS providers, you've got a vehicle, you've got the stuff, you've got the training, you're first out the door. And so now you have a situation where, and I guess I could advance these slides, even though my slides don't really connect to this. But EMS providers as disaster first responders, now you have another situation where not only do you have a disconnect between the EMS providers and the patients from a kind of past history sense, but now you've got maybe a geographic disconnect as well. I might see the same patient every month because they call 911 a lot because they have COPD or CHF or the chronic alcoholism or something like that. But now I'm called to a scene and it's a person from a completely different part of the state or the country who's been displaced because of a disaster, and now I'm seeing them and I really have no idea, and they don't have any idea. Maybe they can't share information with me because of maybe they're unconscious, maybe whatever the situation is. So we've started to kind of carve out these three use cases. So it's the day-to-day use, it's this expansion of the EMS role use through mobile integrated healthcare or community paramedicine, and then it's the disaster use case. And I put this slide up because it really, all of this ties back to being prepared. It's nice for us to say, well, you have to be able to surge 20% surge capacity, or you have to be able to call in extra staff. But really what we have to be able to do is we have to be able to do what we do every day really well, so that when something else happens, when every day becomes not every day, we're not worrying about it. We don't have this break the glass situation where people are trying to figure out, what am I supposed to do again? I know on a normal Tuesday I do this. Now it's Disaster Tuesday. What do I do on Disaster Tuesday? So, I put this up there because it looked nice. But all disasters are local, and that's really the message here. Is it each of these folks, when we're talking about disasters and big scenarios, it does all start right there with those local first responders. It's if that piece isn't there, if those folks aren't plugged into the response and aren't able to absorb what's going on, all of the people who come behind them, by the time you get all the way up to a federal disaster declaration, then you just get people like me coming into your town and I say, well, what's going on? What do you need? And if you don't know, then we're all in trouble. So I think I'll stop there, and I'll let Rachel tell you about how we're trying to connect these two.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. So how many of you all are familiar with health information exchanges in your state or local? Oh, awesome. Okay. And then are any of you familiar with projects that are connecting EMS into those? Okay. All right. So very few. So as you can see, we're really OSC is beginning to look beyond the traditional meaningful use providers. Your eligible hospitals, your eligible providers, and beginning to look at healthcare more in the sense of how public health has always seen healthcare. It's a facet number of people, agencies, organizations that really make up the care of the patient. It's just not one person, it's not just one way of looking at it. And so we really feel that EMS needs to be a part of this. And so a few years ago, Kevin with the ASPR and Lee and I, we put in a proposal to what HHS calls their Idea Lab. It's essentially an in-house shop that essentially wants to help promote ideas of their employees. So we really wanted to begin to explore this whole use case around a disaster type of situation and having first responders, particularly EMS, have access to health information, whether it's at the hospital when they show up there, whether it's at an alternative care site where you might stand up during an emergency, whether it's at a public health site where you're giving mass vaccinations, you want to know about allergies to eggs, et cetera. So that's kind of the whole preface to what we're looking at and to really. So we decided to begin to look at California in particular. We at OSC had done some previous research around looking at California and then Louisiana about their health information exchange infrastructure and where it was in regards to the interest of EMS at the state and local level to begin connecting to these sites. So there was a significant interest in California for this to happen. Everything seemed to be in line. The state EMS authority was very interested in this project, and we had a handful of HIEs, as Lee stated, there's 40 plus HIEs in the state that were also very interested as well. And we're not talking about just the public ones, but also some of the private ones, such as Kaiser, some of your IDNs, things like that. So we really felt that this was a good time to begin to look at this type of use case. So as you can see, we really focused on looking at the earthquake scenario in California. In particular, looking at the areas of San Francisco and Southern California, both because they're along certain fault lines and also because of the huge number of people living in those areas. And so we can imagine that there would be a lot of folks if, you know, incidences were to happen in either one of those, that people would be displaced, would show up at ERs or other types of facilities that were not part of their original part of their care. So as a part of our report, we also hired a consultant, Audacious Inquiry, and they helped us to really begin to frame out this whole system, what we're calling a patient unified lookup system for emergencies, or PULSE. They really helped to flesh out some of the technical requirements, the use case that we're focusing on, some of the policy considerations that were still a barrier, such as consent, things like that, some of the privacy issues, also when does it actually get turned on, in the sense, is it during an actual declared disaster, is it at the local level when that happens, or does it have to be a state declared or even a nationally declared disaster? So some of those discussions were also taking place. We also were able to leverage some letters of intent to participate in this. So if we were actually to get funding to support this effort, would your HIO or HIE participate in this? And if your EMS, your local EMS agency, would you participate? So we were able to get about 30 or so letters of intent from some folks in California that were saying, yes, we're very interested, we really want to support this work. So from that, we also were able to leverage a lot of federal, state, and local partners who were committed to drive PULP forward. In addition, you know, to ASPR, we had interest from the White House and other folks in the disaster realm too, also who are very interested in this effort. So where are we now? So California actually recently applied for some funding that ONC released through states to look at some advanced health information exchange and interoperability. And they received a grant from ONC, and so it'll be through 2017. So they are going to begin to build some of this infrastructure and pieces of the technology that needs to be in place. They're going to actually begin to connect 4 HIOs under the scenario. And then they're also looking at bringing on the EMS component and the data exchange between hospitals and EMS as well. So we're super excited that this is moving forward. I think from this, we'll be able to see what sort of challenges and successes other states and localities can utilize and leverage if they are interested in something similar, which is great. So we want to wrap up just to say that there are some a few resources here, and the links are also through the PowerPoint slide presentation, which you guys should be able to get offline. If not, let me know, I can send it to you. And just like to, there's a website through the Idea Lab that has all of the reports that we did, including the technical pieces that I spoke about that Audacious Inquiry did. So it's all free in regards to if your state or locality is interested in doing something similar. We also have a few blogs that Lee did in regards to talking about this whole disaster scenario and the use of health information exchange. Most recently, ONC also put out a document about about EMS and the use cases that Kevin spoke about, the 3 use cases. I highly encourage you guys to check that out. I think it would be useful for you in trying to sell EMS to come aboard to health information exchange in your states and localities. And then lastly, I also encourage you to join California and follow along what they're doing. They have a blog that they post regularly about their updates in regards to their project and things like that, and as well as a website that also helps. So this is our contact information. Feel free to reach out to us. So I think we have a few minutes just to take any questions that you guys might have before we hand it over to our folks in Prince George's County in Maryland. So any questions anyone has? Great. Oh, yeah. Right, that's a good question. Through the state advanced interoperability grant project that the EMS program from California was awarded, they also awarded to 11 other states, and they're looking at including long-term care and post-acute care facilities, public health. There's also some projects that are looking at behavioral health providers, including them, into health information exchange. And then also some social services. Looking at that as well. And then I also oversee the community HIE grants, which were just awarded recently in September. It's for a very small amount of funding comparably. Some of the folks that some of the projects that we funded are looking at school health nurses to begin to include them in exchanging health information, as well as some social services and behavioral health, and then public health around hearing and screening detection. So, did you have a question?
One of the ideas here, and this is kind of goes to the pulse architecture that's the right technical word, but it is this single sign-on so that someone can flip a switch that you more or less don't really, you as a provider don't realize is being flipped. I mean, I think you would maybe be told that, but it wouldn't change anything that you're doing. You would just be operating on whatever electronic platform. So EMS, I probably should have mentioned this, but many EMS systems now use electronic patient care reporting, tablets or some kind of electronic system in the field. And so their systems report up through their state to their NEMSIS database. And so what the idea here is to have through that sign-on, through whatever portal they're normally using, to kind of on the back end give them this access. So yeah, there's a timeliness issue, but it just becomes one of the break the glass happens, in somebody's office in maybe the state capitol or something where they say, hey, something bad just happened, people are moving from one area to another, flip the switch so that now instead of when I search, I only search my local HIE or whatever local database or system that I normally have access to, now I get broader access. So, there are some hurdles there, but I think each jurisdiction can kind of handle when they turn it on and off, and we at the federal level might influence that with disaster declarations or something. But by the time we're doing that, it's usually we're days into things.
Technically, it's like the road, the tunnel's already built.
Yeah.
The minute something happens, they pull the roadblock,
and
that froze.
Yeah.
Right.
Unlike a system where you have some kind of parallel. Okay, so you use this every day, you get very familiar with it, and then all of a sudden, no, there's a disaster. Let me go use this thing. I don't even remember what my login ID is or my password. We're eliminating that, or at least trying to eliminate that. So it's seamless at the provider level. Again, there are some verification issues that we've been working through. How do the HIEs kind of agree that my login and my, have I had a background check? Am I really a provider? Those sorts of things. But that's all. You can work that out well in advance of the disaster instead of, County X, are all their people that have access? That's the preparedness piece.
And I think what makes everything really unique, and I think to go back to Kevin's point about, supporting EMS day to day, is that our hope is that by getting all of these folks to agree to share data during a disaster type scenario, everyone's going to be able to see, it might be easier just to share it day to day. Like, why is it only during a disaster that we have to share this data? So our hope is that that's kind of what will ultimately happen.
Question?
Other? Yes.
I have a question about sort of the interface between different types of electronic health records. Is it EDR and if there's standards that have NEMSIS?
NEMSIS.
Yeah, well.
Is it?
I mean, NEMSIS isn't a standard. NEMSIS is moving to the HL7 standard, and I'll very quickly get over my head here, but the idea is, and maybe the folks from Prince George's can talk a little bit about, you know, there's the ADT idea, and there's other, there are other electronic ways. The California system uses the interoperability broker, right? Am I getting that right? Where the broker does the searching and then can pull back the information. So, I'll get over my head technically fast, but what I think I can safely say is if Amazon can figure it out for like single sign-on for all these kinds of things and take my credit card and the package shows up on my door the next day, like this is, it can't be that hard. So there are some issues there, but my understanding is the issues mostly go to, everybody's got a proprietary something or other, and nobody wants to lose market share, even though it's not really clear that any market share is at issue here. It seems like every time we've seen this get implemented, it's a benefit to everyone, and there's nobody really losing anything. So, so I think HL7 is probably the answer to your question, but I've said a lot more words than that.
So one of the things about the California project particularly is that connecting the HIEs is not really contingent on which EHRs are feeding into the HIEs. It's more about the kind of technology that the HIEs are using. And so there were only four types of technology being used across all 43 HIEs in California, which makes it much easier to connect, to really map those four technologies that are already very, very close. That's what made this a viable project, because it actually has been a very small amount of money to actually figure out how to do this. And one of the great benefits of this was that we were able to really learn from what has been happening in Maryland. There's a lot of expertise there. And also, letting a state and a region make a determination that's best for them was incredibly empowering and something that advanced this light years ahead of us trying to mandate something in this space. And I really think that this is a better model, the way that this project has gone, for how we should really grow health information exchange. Because at the end of the day, everyone has the common desires, and really letting states and regions make decisions will get us there a lot faster than the federal government trying to mandate it.
Great. Any other questions? Oh.
So the governance is, so basically they took the DRSA and they morphed it into what is known as the CalDRSA, because California has laws that go above the DRSA. So they have a special version called the CalDRSA, and it was incredible, like 23 organizations signed it the first week. And it was shocking. I mean, every time it was like, bam, you won the lottery, bam, you won the lottery. Because we know that almost never, ever happens. And that really goes to what I was saying is that when the state was able to sort of grow this themselves and to put out a very good public good use case for why they should do that, people came to the table. So it was exciting.
Great, thank you. All right, I'm gonna give this one. Oh, yeah.